Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 5 of The Right Take. I'm Eric Lendrum.
I'm Jacob Grandstaff.
And we are still here, although once again, for the second week in a row, we unfortunately have to report some very unfortunate news on the social media front. So last week, of course, we ended up off of Twitter one way or another. I was kicked off. Jacob made the decision to shut down his Twitter account, and we both mutually made the decision to shut down the podcast Twitter account. Now it is YouTube that wants a piece of the Right Take pie. So 4 episodes in, we already got a ding on YouTube. Episode number 2, MAGA's Last Stand, which was actually our most popular video on YouTube, it got the most views, has been deleted for violating community guidelines with regards to spam, deceptive material, and scams. So we already got a warning from YouTube, which is not a strike, but they said next time this happens, we will get a strike, which then follows the, of course, the baseball analogy of 3 strikes, you're out. So we are already, even we just got started, and YouTube already wants to take us down. So be sure to follow us at the video sharing platforms, the YouTube alternatives that actually care about a little something called free speech, called the First Amendment, Rumble and BitChute. All of our videos are posted there, uncensored, completely full and unedited. You can find us there. You can find us, of course, on Gab and Minds and other major alternative social media platforms. You can find the full list of social media sites, as well as podcast hosting services, where we are available on our website, righttakepodcast.com/contact. Where, of course, on that same page, you can also send us a message via the contact submission form. And on that note, I wanted to address one message we received from that page from John, our loyal listener, John. If you're out there, I'm sure you're listening right now, who asked if we have anything set up along the lines of a Patreon or PayPal. We do not yet have that set up for you, John, but we will have that set up very soon. So be sure to continue to follow all of our latest progress at our website, righttakepodcast.com, and go to the page righttakepodcast.com/contact. So speaking of YouTube, though, I think as bad as it is, yeah, to get a video deleted when we're only 4 episodes in, to get already what is essentially a pre-strike, a semi-strike already from YouTube, which is not a good sign for the longevity of our channel there.
Well, it's not a good sign for the longevity of YouTube, actually, honest.
Exactly. Yeah, we still have outlets, of course. But even then, I would much rather have to deal with that than deal with what good old Joe Biden is dealing with right now. So, but if you take a quick look through the videos, you will notice a recurring theme. You take a look, go ahead and hop over to White House, the White House, the certified YouTube channel, the White House. The first video posted in the Biden era is the inauguration. It's 32 minutes long, the inauguration of the 46th president of the United States. Take a quick look down below the video player. It has over 767,000 views at the time of this recording, which is pretty good. 13,000 likes and 67,000 dislikes. You go over to another video. President Biden signs executive orders and other presidential actions. It's him in the Oval Office signing his a million executive orders or whatever. 6,800 likes, 36,000 dislikes. Biden swears in day one presidential appointees in a virtual ceremony. 6,500 likes, 26,000 dislikes. And I love this one. January 20th, 2021, press briefing by Press Secretary Jen Psaki, the first press briefing from the new press secretary. 7,700 likes, 32,000 dislikes. Talk about getting ratioed. This is glorious, man. And if you check the videos too, you'll notice the comments have been turned off. They don't allow comments, and you will see why. If you were early enough, I did manage to hop onto one of the videos, the aforementioned video of the president of Biden signing those executive orders in the Oval Office before they turned off comments. And all the comments were like this. All the comments were all getting hundreds and hundreds of upvotes. Some of them include, YouTube should hire Dominion to alter the dislike-like votes, or is that for mail-in ballots only? The only good thing about Joe Biden being president are these comments. I'm so early that they haven't turned off comments yet, LMFAO. They eventually turned off comments for that one and for all the YouTube videos.
They'll be turning off the likes and dislikes pretty soon.
Absolutely. And the greatest thing about that, too, technically what YouTube does, you cannot disable the like-dislike feature. All you can disable is the ability for the viewers, the average, you know, just the internet going viewer clicking on the video to see what the like dislike ratio is. The like, the little thumbs up and thumbs down icons will always be there for you to click on regardless. You just won't see how many likes or dislikes there are. So grab your screenshots, boys, grab your screenshots before they delete that too, and just snapshot this wonderful ratioing of literally every single video is like that. So with that said, it's time to move on from the fun stuff and move on to the super serious policy talk. So, Jacob, how have Biden's first few executive orders and various other actions as president, how have they been received since he took office?
So one of the ping pong games that the Democrats have to try to play is they have to placate a million different interest groups. And two of those interest groups that are in very stark contrast to one another is the environmental lobby and the union lobby. And, you know, environmentalists, it's one thing to be an environmentalist. It's another to believe that the world is actually going to come to an end if we don't do something to address climate change. And it looks like Biden is leaning more toward the environmentalist side. And I can't say I blame him, because they actually do wield a little bit more power than the unions do, considering union membership in the United States has gone down dramatically. I believe in 2017, only 11% of American workers were unionized. And if you take out the non-blue-collar workers, like the service industry workers and all that, if you take out the public sector unions, then it's, of course, much, much lower. But unions used to make up the backbone of the Democratic Party. Today, Biden can just basically push them to the side and face no consequences. And we see an example of this with the Keystone XL pipeline. One of the first actions that Biden took as president was to kill that project. And of course, in the process, he killed 11,000 jobs immediately, not to mention the tens of thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of jobs that would be created because of that pipeline, not just working on the pipeline, but the other jobs around it. I remember whenever I was in college, our geography professor, who was from Northern Iowa, he said, if you really want to pay off some student loan debt real quick, you ought to go to South Dakota, because there were so many people that needed jobs, there needed workers up there, and there nobody wants to live in South Dakota. This is kind of what happens whenever you have a project like this. It doesn't just affect the project itself. It creates service industry jobs. McDonald's workers back then, this was, you know, 8 years ago, they were starting out $15, $16 an hour just because these jobs pay so much money that it boosts the salaries of the workers around them. So whenever he killed this pipeline, it didn't just kill the union jobs. It also killed a bunch of other potential jobs that would be created.
But it's got to be a record somewhere for the highest number of jobs killed by a presidential action in a single day.
Correct, right out the gate. And basically their attitude about it is these workers can just find employment in other sectors. And they're claiming, eventually there will be green jobs created and we can retrain these employees to work in, work windmills, build solar panels and stuff. But what's interesting is you had several unions that came out and endorsed Biden last year. The Labor's International Union of North America endorsed Biden last fall, and it looks like they're not very happy with what he's done. They released a statement saying, in revoking this permit, the Biden administration has chosen to listen to the voices of fringe activists instead of union members and the American consumer on day one. Sadly, the Biden administration has now put thousands of union workers out of work. For the average American family, it means energy costs will go up and communities will no longer see the local investments that come with pipeline construction. And also in October, the North American Building Trades Union endorsed Biden. But their president, Sean McGarvey, said the day after Biden signed the executive order that the organization was, quote, deeply disappointed in the decision. So we're seeing this already right out the gate. Biden is having to pick. Does he want to placate the environmentalists, those like the AOC types who believe the world is literally coming to an end and we have 12 years to save the planet? Or is he going to side with the American workers? You know, I've got to be honest with you, Eric. I don't have a lot of sympathy for these union workers. I don't have a lot of sympathy for these union bosses. They knew what Joe Biden was planning before he got elected.
I remember during the primaries that he was talking like that, taking the same Green New Deal stance as everybody else. And then only when it came to the general election did Trump started hammering him to his face in the debates. He then turned around and say, I am not banning fracking, no matter how much Donald Trump lies. And yet here he turns around and does this. He kills the Keystone XL pipeline. And it's very clear. Yeah, he absolutely is going to side with the environmentalists. Because you talked about earlier how the administration said that they will have to get new jobs, right? They said, these people could just get new jobs. That literally is, on a scale of let them eat cake to learn to code, like that's definitely somewhere in the upper scale of how little the left thinks of the workers who, as you said, yeah, used to be their base, used to be their backbone. Because they really do believe the world was coming to an end. The common thing you see from these leftists, like on Twitter, before I was banned from Twitter, you would constantly see these AOC Green New Deal types all saying, Yeah, they can get another job. We can't get another planet.
Which, right, right.
That logic makes sense if you really do believe the Earth is coming to an end. But of course it's not. I mean, ask Al Gore, who said that the... Didn't he first predict, like, the melting of the ice caps in, like, 2010? Say that would happen in 2010 or something like that? Like,
I believe it was 2010. But the thing is, these environmentalists, these people who believe that the world literally is coming to an end, their jobs aren't on the line. Their livelihood isn't on the line. They work in white-collar jobs in cities. You know, they don't have to depend on this. Their families don't depend on this. Well, first of all, most of them don't have families anyway. They're all on birth control. They don't plan to ever have kids. And it's like AOC was lamenting the fact that she'll never be able to have kids because, the world just it can't sustain more human life. They actually do believe that the world is coming to an end. And this has real-world consequences. You know, used to, we would think of environmentalists as a bunch of crazy tree huggers, and nobody really paid them much attention. Well, suddenly now that they're getting political power, these Democratic union workers are starting to wake up and say, well, wait a minute, you know, I thought this was just, you know, these were a bunch of fringe, pink-haired, green-haired commies in Seattle. I didn't actually think that the Democratic Party would take them seriously. But look, the Democratic Party exists to win elections. The Democratic Party does not exist to help workers. It does not exist to help American workers. It exists to win elections. And if they feel that the balance of power has shifted to the urban centers where college-educated, earth-worshipping commies have taken the lead and have the most, you know, have the loudest voice in their party, they are going to redirect their priorities to, you know, meet the demand of their voters. And this is something that these union, you know, like I said, I really don't have a lot of sympathy for these union workers. They showed up and voted for Biden. We see this is Terry O'Sullivan, general president of the Laborers International Union of North America. In his endorsement, he said over the crucial next few months, he said the 500,000 strong, proud, and united men and women of LUNA will be on the front lines relentlessly working to elect Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and leading the way to fulfill their mantra of build back better. And you got to understand the media, because of the media pressure, the social media pressure, you've got all of the entertainers that had been supporting Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Even The Rock came out and endorsed them. You got a lot of these. I understand you got a lot of workers who they consume entertainment. They see Donald Trump. They see just this boorish, uncouth, unpleasant president that all of their friends hate. And they see Joe Biden just kind of this, you know, old friendly Uncle Joe from Scranton. And they're thinking, okay, you know, they're hearing Joe throw out dog whistles to the environmentalist left. And they're thinking, our union boss endorsed Joe. If Joe was really going to screw us over, our union wouldn't have endorsed him. And I understand you got these pink-haired commies in Seattle and, you know, New York City that he's got to placate. So he's throwing out some dog whistles to try to make them think that he's going to throw something their way. But what they don't understand, power no longer lies in Minnesota. It no longer lies in Iowa. It no longer lies in Wisconsin. Now it lies on the coast. This is where it's coming. And if they do away with the Electoral College, you know, unions in the heartland, they can forget about it. They're screwed because now it's the people in the coast, the college-educated, white-collar workers in the coast who command things. And what's interesting, this kind of shows exactly where the Democratic Party has headed. This is an article from NPR. January came out just 6 days ago. So this is as the unions are pushing back against Joe Biden's position on killing the Keystone. It says, union pushing Keystone XL faces racial discrimination suit. This is the headline on NPR, our publicly taxpayer-funded news source. And what the headline is trying to show these unions, they're not your friend because they're actually racist. They're actually ingrained in old American racism. So if you hear unions protesting against environmentalist actions, you need to remember these are a bunch of old racists that are doing this. And so
just old white guys, gun clingers, Bible clingers, all
right,
that stuff.
Right, from Minnesota and Wisconsin. So it goes on. It says President-elect Joe Biden is under pressure to walk away from his pledge to block Keystone XL oil pipeline. On Tuesday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said completing the project is a key priority for him. So, you know, Joe Biden is to the left of Justin Trudeau on this.
Because that's the thing. Yeah, this is also a matter of diplomacy between the United States and Canada. Like,
right, it's a Canadian company.
The first thing, already off the bat, you're pissing off one of our two closest geographic neighbors. Like, that's also – it's terrible diplomacy to really throw that and to throw the support of the workers completely out the window just to appease the blue-haired college feminist environmentalists. I get what you're saying about how you feel little to no sympathy for those workers who still voted for Biden. I would only push back in the sense, like you said, they consume entertainment and all their Hollywood stars and certainly the media. When they're feeding these lies to these people about President Trump and about how Joe Biden is so great, can you really fault them for being brainwashed by the media? Can you really fault them for believing? Again, these same people, they're old school. They still trust the media for the most part. They trust Hollywood. So Well, I absolutely have no sympathy for the bosses. The union bosses can go to hell as far as I'm concerned. They know what's up and they know what they did was wrong. It's the workers I'm talking about who are, they're under social pressure. They feel kind of forced to do it. And only now do they realize, like, I think certainly most of them realize the mistake that they made. And that certainly is better than he's doing these terrible things and they still will not wake up to the mistake they made.
Well, if Joe Biden's decision to kill this pipeline wasn't a wake-up call to them about just how expendable they are for the Democrats, I guess the Democratic based media will definitely wake them up. This reading on this NPR article says on this side of the border, on the American side, one of the unions that want Biden to allow construction on the pipeline to continue is an Oklahoma local with a history of racism and sexism. Pipeliners Local 798 faces a new class action lawsuit that claims black members were denied promotions that were given instead to less qualified white workers. And it goes on and on, talks about how this union has a history of racism. And the basic, I mean, you can go to NPR and read it. The premise of it is that these unions are they're not necessarily an ally in the cause of racial justice. That just because they vote Democrat, just because they traditionally voted Democrat, whenever they're complaining about Joe Biden's attack on, say, fossil fuels, they're basically, it's all fueled by racism. Everything has to tie back to race.
That's the supreme doctrine of the left at this point. Everything is racist.
Correct. So these unions that are fighting for their jobs, basically just fighting for the right to work, the right to live, the right to maintain their standard of living. Now, because they're standing up and saying, hey, we don't want to get laid off. I mean, there were 11,000 workers that just got laid off just like that. They are now out of work.
They've got a stroke of a pen. One executive order. Boom.
Exactly. And now because they're fighting because they're upset about the fact that Joe Biden just wiped out their jobs, we got to remember that these union workers are racist. Their union is racist. The history of their union is racist. They've always tried to attack black people. They've always been aggressive. I guess what's the term against black bodies? That's the new woke term that they're now pushing about black and brown bodies.
I just can't wait for when these woke racial revisionist history morons find out about a fellow by the name of Cesar Chavez. Another famous union leader who was most definitely not white and yet would definitely be considered a racist by today's standards.
Well, what's interesting is Joe Biden actually put a picture of Cesar Chavez behind him in the Oval Office. Cesar Chavez, he was a labor leader.
Yeah, United Farm Workers.
And if you read the media, it seems like he's trying to, you know, because he lost the Latino vote compared to other Democrats by a whopping ridiculous percentage. And he's basically trying to say, look, I'm going to put one of your heroes up here. But if I go through Falls Church and I ask, you know, the Guatemalan workers, if they know who Cesar Chavez is, nobody, none of them are going to know who Cesar Chavez is. Cesar Chavez is nobody to them. He was just the United Farm Workers union leader. I mean, he's kind of a hero to Mexican Americans, but to Hispanics in general, he's not. And when you look at what he actually stood for, he actually used Hispanic workers to help deport illegal immigrants because those illegals were a threat to his union workers.
So he was America first in a lot of ways. He understood that illegal immigration was a huge threat to American workers first and foremost.
Just more identity politics without even looking into what these individuals stood for. But yeah, this is interesting. This is only the tip of the iceberg. This is only going to continue. If union workers think that they're going to get a seat at the table against environmentalists, it's not going to happen. And these so-called good-paying green jobs, they're going to, even if they did come, they're going to be years in the making, and they're not going to employ nearly as many workers as as a pipeline would. But yeah, so this is kind of what we can look forward to going forward in the Biden administration. You know what? If you're a union worker and you're still clinging to the Democratic Party, I don't know. You know, it's kind of like you try to do the same thing over and over again and expect different results. So we're going to actually spend the bulk of the time of this episode going over his inaugural address, kind of give our perspective on the Biden inaugural address, on his philosophy. We're basically going to show the difference between his philosophy and the philosophy of America First Republic, not just Republic. I mean, there's plenty of non-Republicans who are America First. Senator Amy Klobuchar was the one doing the introducing.
This was definitely the bone being thrown to her, by the way, because she remember that she and Pete Buttigieg very strategically and systematically withdrew on the same day from the primaries to help give Super Tuesday to Joe Biden. And obviously the Buttigieg was rewarded for it. He was given the Secretary of Transportation role, but they couldn't give Klobuchar a seat because she's in the Senate and they need her there. But this was the closest thing they could give her to a cabinet position, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. So this basically she had to take the fall for Biden, so you know, because she wasn't going to beat Trump. They knew that Biden could beat Trump of the three that were left. So
I love one thing too. Lord Conrad Black in American Greatness, when he wrote an article about summarizing what a field of non-entities the 2020 Democrat primary was. He described Amy Klobuchar very simply as Walter Mondale in drag, and you can't unsee it once you have heard that description. But yeah, she had something very interesting to say. Obviously, very forced, obviously, she had to say this because of considering what happened at the Capitol a couple weeks prior, but she had to throw a mention of this into her introduction to Joe Biden at the inauguration.
2 weeks ago, when an angry, violent mob staged an insurrection and desecrated this temple of our democracy, it awakened us to our responsibilities as Americans.
I'm pretty sure there's a good word for that. This constant talk about the Capitol is a temple, it's the tabernacle of our society. I'm pretty sure that's called blasphemy. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's like American society has moved so far beyond Christianity at this point to where people don't really have anything that they worship anymore, seriously. So we're kind of almost moving into the realm of pagan Republic Rome, the Roman Republic, in which we don't have any gods to worship. So we've got to try to find something we have in common. We think, okay, democracy. We all like democracy. So let's worship democracy, the god of democracy. It'll have its temples. It'll have its... We'll even hear later on in Joe Biden's speech, he makes allusion to this. So, but yeah, just the religious references they make to the Capitol over and over again is really sickening, especially if you're a Christian.
Indeed. And that's, as you said, that's something that Joe Biden did mention later on in his speech. As he got started, he said something very similar. And we had to speed this up just a little bit because the way he talks, it's just so
yeah,
slow.
Yeah, we need to hear 45-year-old Biden speak. Yeah,
exactly. Go back to the Joe Biden of the 90s even.
Speaker Pelosi, Leader Schumer, Leader McConnell, Vice President Pence, my distinguished guests, my fellow Americans. This is America's day. This is democracy's day. A day of history and hope, of renewal and resolve through a crucible. For the ages, America has been tested anew, and America has risen to the challenge. Today, we celebrate the triumph not of a candidate, but of a cause, the cause of democracy. The people, the will of the people, has been heard, and the will of the people has been heeded. We've learned again that democracy is precious, democracy is fragile. And at this hour, my friends, democracy has prevailed. So now, on this hallowed ground where just a few days ago, violence sought to shake the Capitol's very foundation, we come together as one nation, under God, indivisible, to carry out the peaceful transfer of power as we have for more than two centuries.
Uh-oh, I think that's plagiarism again. He literally just plagiarized what Klobuchar said a few moments ago.
Right,
can this
right.
guy stop committing plagiarism for just 5 seconds, please?
But the thing is, this is one thing about the Democrats in the media we saw in 2020, and they really started pushing this in high gear in 2018, is they would put out a memo, basically, this is what we're all going to – these are our talking points, and everyone would parrot it. Now the talking points are this is hallowed ground. This is, you know, it's the sanctimonious religiosity. And Biden mentions here on this hallowed ground, and there's a reason for that. There's – you know, if someone's religion is attacked, they're going to be a lot more apt to have a violent reaction against whoever is attacking their religion than it would be if someone were just attacking their ideas, you know, or their politics. So by bringing this into a religious context, they want to try to create this aura of religiosity so that people will be as outraged at the people who stormed the Capitol as Catholics would at a mob who desecrated a Catholic church.
Or how Americans should have been outraged when Antifa and Black Lives Matter tried burning one of America's most sacred churches to the ground, an actual historic and actual sacred site. But of course, again, thanks to the media, nobody cared about that. But yeah, so on that same note, he had to continue a little further into his speech with more exaggerated comparisons, shall we say, that drew upon some real historical tragedies in order to try to make the situation today seem even worse than it actually is.
We'll press forward with speed and urgency, for we have much to do in this winter of peril and significant possibilities. Much to repair, much to restore, much to heal, much to build, and much to gain. Few people in our nation's history have been more challenged or found a time more challenging or difficult than the time we're in now. Once-in-a-century virus that silently stalks the country has taken as many lives in 1 year as America lost in all of World War II.
This goes back, just like we mentioned in a previous episode, this is something that Peter Schiff brought out whenever the COVID became a worldwide pandemic. He pointed out that people were comparing it to World War II, and he said, well, in World War II, think of all the young lives that were snuffed out. You had millions and millions of young people from all around the world. And even if you just want to focus on Americans, you had hundreds of thousands of Americans who were wounded or lost their lives, whose lives and health was snuffed out in their youth and their prime. These are 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-olds that are killed. And he said, so there is a difference between a 20-year-old getting shot and killed who has his entire life ahead of him, could potentially get married, have kids, send his kids off to college, have, you know, kids that become, you know, become great, do great things. Compare that to an 85-year-old dying from coronavirus. Yes, it's sad when anyone passes away, but an 80-year-old, 82-year-old, 85-year-old dying of coronavirus is simply not the same thing. It's not in the same ballpark as a world war that's destroying cities, that's killing innocent civilians, wiping out women and children, you know, killing young men on the battlefield. This is simply not comparable. How many of these people who have died from coronavirus would have died in 2020 if coronavirus had not existed? A lot of these people had heart attacks. They had, you know, they happened to have
underlying conditions.
Right. They had underlying conditions. They happened to have a heart attack or some kind of disease, and they died, and they happened to have had COVID when they passed away. How many of those people would have passed away in 2020 if coronavirus had never existed?
I believe the CDC actually admitted only about 6% of all COVID deaths were strictly attributed to the virus itself,
yes,
whereas the remaining 94% were due to underlying conditions of some kind, meaning had it not been for the virus, those underlying conditions, they probably would not have died. So it's all exaggerated. It's all that to an extent of the virus is a hoax in terms of just the sheer numbers. Like you see the latest number now already is like, what, over 410,000 deaths? Okay, how many of those are actually part of that 6%? It would probably be a very irrelevant number, more probably on par with the swine flu, if I had to guess.
Millions of jobs have been lost. Hundreds of thousands of businesses closed. A cry for racial justice. Some 400 years in the making moves us. The dream of justice for all will be deferred no longer.
400 years in the making led to BLM burning down half of America's cities. Am I understanding this right, Jacob?
Well, when you consider that apparently, you know, for 400 years, black people have been struggling for racial justice, and finally the dam just broke. They, you know, that's the narrative. The dam finally in 2020, the dam just broke, and they said we've had enough. We've been at this for 400 years, and it hasn't worked. It's funny how the 1619 project just happened to come out in 2019 that led up to this. You know, it's almost kind of coincidental. You know, you got this major project that becomes extremely popular, extremely, you know, it's really pushed by the media class. This narrative that for 400 years black people have been struggling for you know, racial recognition, and then in 2020 we just happened to have riots based off of one particular incident in which it turns out the officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck, he was following the protocol of the police department. And he was, it wasn't like he had any anger or anything. He was just, the people are filming him. He's just looking at him like, you know, I'm just doing my job. This is, I'm trying to help this guy who's suffering from, what is it, delirium, you know, excited delirium or
clearly,
something.
Clearly, yeah, he was definitely under the influence of something. And again, the autopsy reports confirmed he ultimately died of a fentanyl overdose.
When you ingrain the mentality into people that their people, that their ethnicity has been struggling for 400 years to achieve freedom, this basically, they call it the long freedom struggle, the 400-year long freedom struggle. And something like this happens and you don't have the full context. You don't need the full context. You already know. Okay, that's a white police officer. That's a black man that he's kneeling on. And for 400 years, we know that the authorities, that the police, because, you know, the narrative projected is that police departments have their origins in slave catchers. There wouldn't be police departments if there hadn't been slave catchers. It's like they don't think, wait a minute, they have police departments in Germany and France and Russia and China. They never had slavery over there like we had it here, but somehow they have police. They don't seem to make that connection. But the fact that Joe Biden is mentioning this in his inaugural address, this is he's really just throwing a bone to the black intellectual class. That's all he's doing. That's all this line is for.
And speaking of throwing bones, going back to what we talked about earlier, he also had to throw another bone to the AOC Green New Deal environmentalist crowd.
The cry for survival comes from the planet itself, a cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear now.
Okay, President Gore, we get it. We get it. Man, when do you start talking about the man bear pig, Joe?
A cry for, what was it? Play that, let's play that clip one more time.
A cry for survival comes from the planet itself. a cry that can't be any more desperate or any more clear. And now,
I imagine that the planet has a very bass voice, like a very, very deep voice. Help me,
save,
Joe Biden.
Save me. I'm gonna die in 12 years. I've been diagnosed with Earth cancer.
The crust of the Earth breaks open, and it's a Titan hiding inside.
You have until 2032. Please save me.
Oh my God. Al Gore, succeed where Al Gore failed.
A cry of survival comes from the planet itself. I don't understand. How can any person who has been educated? Well, that's the problem. They've been educated out of common sense. Like, I'm thinking, how can any college-educated person with half a brain cell watch him say that? This is the president of the United States. He's up there in his inaugural address saying a cry for survival comes out from the planet itself. I don't know. How do you – and again, this kind of goes back to the religiosity that they bring. You know, it's kind of like they're making a religion out of democracy. You know, you got the hallowed ground of the Capitol grounds. You got the temple, which is the Capitol. And the religious fervor of these people who actually believe that the world is coming to an end, it really is no different than, you know, people who their entire Christianity revolves around the end times. You've probably met these people or heard these, you know, been around these people. Everything, you know, they don't really focus on anything about Christian, you know, they're Christians, but they don't focus on anything about the Bible or Christianity except the end times. That's their whole existence. Just look at watching the signs or keeping up with the news. Just so you can watch and follow the signs to find out when the end of the world is coming. That's kind of like these people. It's really no different. It's basically just a religious fervor. And, you know, back in the day when the religious right was real strong in America, you would have non-religious Republicans who would throw a bone to the religious right. They would say things in their speeches to kind of let them know, hey, I'm with you on this. I understand where you're coming from. That's kind of how it was with Biden. Biden doesn't believe that there's a cry of survival coming up from the earth. He doesn't believe any of this crap. He's just going along, just like the racial stuff. I mean, if you go back and watch speeches that Biden gave on race back in the 70s, back in the 80s, he was about as he was just slightly to the left of George Wallace on a lot of this stuff. So, I mean, the fact that he's now pretending to be Al Gore on this, again, it's just he's just throwing another bone. This is his bone that he throws to the white intellectual class. So he had to mention the 400 years to throw a bone to the black intellectual class. Now he's got to throw a bone to the white intellectual class. And what's interesting is I went to an art museum, and it's funny because all of the artists, all the white artists, that everything that they draw, everything they paint, their art always revolves around animism. The black artists, everything revolves around black nationalism. That, you know, nothing's just art for the beauty of, you know, this modern art.
It's all nothing. Art has to be political now.
It all has to be political. And it's the same way. These are the two factions of the Democratic Party that the Democratic politicians have to keep happy. They've got to keep the black nationalists happy, and they've got to keep the white environment, the upper class, rich white kids, the, you know, the white environmentalists, they've got to keep them happy. And then the ones that are left out are the union workers. And this was what we see with the Keystone XL pipeline. They're not environmentalists. They care about the environment like we all do.
They don't want to pollute. They recycle.
Right,
all that
they're
fun
responsible.
Stuff.
They're actually more responsible. And they're more responsible than half the people in Washington, D.C. is. D.C. is one of the most polluted areas, not the downtown area. And I'll tell you, I've never been anywhere in my life where I see more people just throwing shit out the window as they're driving down the street. And this is everybody. This is black, white, rich, poor, middle class. Everywhere you go in D.C. and even in the suburbs, you're constantly seeing people roll down their window and throw stuff out the window. You don't see that in middle America. You don't see that in Indiana and Alabama and Wisconsin. These people don't pollute like the people in the city, at least in this city, do. So the people who claim to care the most about the environment, they're often the ones who pollute the most. These union workers, I guarantee you, they don't pollute. They don't throw trash in rivers and stuff. But yet, you know, they're not environmentalists. They have some common sense. They don't believe the world is coming to an end. But so they're the ones left outside. Now, the Democratic Party is the party of rich white environmentalists and middle class black nationalists.
And, you know, moving on to the next part of his speech here, I just got to say, when I first watched the speech live on mute, because I think that's the best way to watch Joe Biden, just whenever he's talking, playing on mute with some evil music playing in the background, some Legend of Zelda Ganon's theme music playing in the background on my computer on a loop for 30 minutes. But I was reading the captions and just reading the context of the speech. This to me, you know what I call him after this speech? I call him President Platitudes. Every single thing he said was the same stupid career politician platitude crap you have heard a million times over from thousands of other politicians. It's like when during the second debate, Joe Biden throughout the whole, we got to talk about the issues that Americans talk about around the dinner table. And Trump just called him out on the spot. He's like, come on, dinner table, Joe, really? That's how many times have we heard that before? That's so weak. That's such a career politician thing to say. He called him out for the kind of stuff you've heard from every suit on Capitol Hill, whether they're wearing a blue tie or a red tie. And that's what the speech was. There were no specifics. There was nothing creative or unique or even funny or anything that stood out. But to me, there was one part that stood out in terms of its content, and it was this part. And it stands out for all the wrong reasons.
A rise of political extremism, white supremacy, domestic terrorism that we must confront and we will defeat.
This, oh my God. So this goes back to, you remember when he first announced his candidacy, right? Yep. He first announced his candidacy with a stupid little video basically saying, I'm running because I'm disappointed and offended at what I saw happen in Charlottesville. You know, he basically made Charlottesville his whole campaign. And then there was, after he quote unquote won the election, there was that leaked audio of him talking to left wing civil rights and activist leaders basically saying, I was the only candidate running talking about Charlottesville. So he's built his entire campaign on this lie. This lie, which has been debunked multiple times. It's the same as the gender pay gap and so many other left wing lies that keeps getting debunked, but just will not go away. This lie that there's this rise of right wing, far right, white supremacist terrorism. And it's total garbage. There's no evidence to support it. But by throwing this out there, and I said this a while ago, based on that campaign announcement Charlottesville video, and then there was even a Washington Post op-ed shortly after the election that actually called for Biden to do this. This is going to be Joe Biden's signature domestic initiative. I'm willing to bet some money on this. His signature domestic initiative will be, I took the fight to right-wing, white supremacist, far-right, alt-right terrorists on American soil. This whole meme that, oh, the Islamic terror threat is gone now. It's been replaced by the white supremacist threat. That's going to be his new shtick. And get ready for him to, especially with a guy like Merrick Garland as his attorney general, a guy who has it out for Republicans or conservatives in general because he was blocked from that SCOTUS nomination in the final year of the Obama administration. He is absolutely going to, and certainly with what happened to the Capitol, I think if nothing else, Joe Biden is a petty man. You know he wanted his inauguration crowd size to be bigger than Trump's so he could wave it around and say, ha ha ha, I had more people than you, because there was that argument about how many people were at Trump's inauguration. But because of what happened to the Capitol, ostensibly because of that very peaceful protest there, he was not able to have an inauguration. And he, I know, you know, he is livid behind the scenes that he did not get to have a normal inauguration. And he blames the far right, the alt-right, the white supremacist boogeyman, and he's going to use whatever power he has to seek revenge on those people. Mark my words.
To overcome these challenges, to restore the soul and secure the future of America, requires so much more than words. It requires the most elusive of all things in a democracy, unity. Unity.
He had to repeat himself there just for emphasis, even though, again, we're playing this at 1.25 speed, by the way, so that pause was a lot longer and more dramatic sounding for him. But unity, unity, unity. Spare me, Joe. You literally announced your candidacy for president of the United States calling Donald Trump a neo-Nazi. Spare me. I don't want to hear it.
So I'm going to support unity after we lock up all these Republicans in prison for being supposed white supremacists.
And impeach President Trump a second time, by the way,
right.
As well.
His idea of unity is kind of like we achieved unity in Japan. You know, we went over there and crushed them, destroyed them. We made them accept democracy on our terms.
We made them learn of our peaceful ways by force.
Exactly. And now, guess what? We've got unity with the Japanese people. We're not at odds with the Japanese anymore because, you know, they accepted unity on our terms, on our conditions. And that's basically what Biden is wanting right here. He sees this almost as a cold Civil War military defeat. So he's telling people. Maybe he sees himself as Abraham Lincoln after the Civil War, basically telling the South, okay, I want unity, but you're going to accept things on our terms, which is understandable from, you know, if you're Abraham Lincoln after the Civil War.
After a literal Civil War,
but we haven't had a Civil War in this country, and the fact that Biden is acting like this, like, I just want unity. We just want to get along. If you'll just come over to my side, we can all get along and be friends.
According to Joe Biden's inaugural address, we're in the middle of an uncivil war right now. I guarantee
right.
you, the speechwriter who came up with that line is so satisfied with himself for coming up with that line.
Yeah.
To fight the foes we face, anger, resentment, and hatred. Extremism, lawlessness, violence, disease, joblessness, and hopelessness. With unity, we can do great things, important things. We can right wrongs. We can put people to work in good jobs. We can teach our children in safe schools. We can overcome the deadly virus. We can reward work and rebuild the middle class and make health care secure for all. We can deliver racial justice, and we can make America once again the leading force for good in the world.
So, again, going back to what I said before of President Platitudes. My God, how many platitudes was that in just that one roughly 50-second clip alone right there?
Yeah, well, I mean, most presidents, whenever they're given an inaugural address, they'll throw out some platitudes. But, I mean, you know, Biden, he's going to make the most out of it. But one thing that I'm a little bit concerned about is the fact that he wants to make America a leading force of good, a leading force for good in the world. I mean, I'm wondering, is this George W. Bush talking here or is this Joe Biden? And when you look at their foreign policy, there's really not a lot of difference between George W. Bush and Joe Biden, which that should be extreme. If it weren't for the coronavirus and the constant domestic political turmoil, that would be more at the forefront of people's minds. The fact that this, I mean, this is, remember, this is a guy who supported the Iraq War. This is a guy who supported the bombing of Libya. This is a guy who wanted, really wanted regime change in Syria. So, but this kind of goes back to Woodrow Wilson. This really is a strain that has always existed in the Democratic Party, even when they were opposed to a Republican-led war like Vietnam or Iraq. They're still at their heart Wilsonians. They believe that the United States should be the arsenal of democracy in the world. And, you know, unless the Republican Party is actually going to grow a backbone and kick the interventionists to the curb, basically tell them, you know, if you're going to be an interventionist, you need to get out of our party, go, you know, go be a Democrat, then I don't really see there being much willpower to stop this.
I know speaking of unity can sound to some like a foolish fantasy these days. I know the forces that divide us are deep and they are real. But I also know they are not new. Our history has been a constant struggle between the American ideal that we're all are created equal and the harsh, ugly reality that racism, nativism, fear, demonization have long torn us apart. The battle is perennial, and victory is never assured.
Nativism. You had to throw that one in there. Because nativism is not necessarily a bad thing either. That's essentially just another component of being a nationalist, right?
Correct. But he's basically saying that he's assuming that all good people would want to root out all of these things and throw a nativism in with, I mean, yeah, everyone's against racism. We don't, nobody believes, I mean, we shouldn't believe that your race is superior. But nativism is simply putting your people first. You're putting your nation first. Again, Iraq, Germany, Russia didn't hire Biden. The American people hired Biden. We need Biden to work for the American people and for the American citizens that exist today, not the American citizens that may exist 50 years from now through the, you know, as the children and grandchildren of future immigrants. And this is a problem with his philosophy. And, you know, I understand he keeps claiming over and over again that he wants unity. You can't unite, you know, the right and left simply cannot unite on this point. This is an irreconcilable difference. Nativism is at the heart and soul of conservatism. It is the heart and soul of the Republican Party. The Republican Party came out of what the I believe it was called the American Party. They were derided as the Know Nothing Party in the 1850s, but they were essentially a nativist party. That was part and parcel of the roots of the Republican Party. So, you know, it's kind of hard to claim you want unity and then demonize nativism along and throw it in the same bucket with racism, because the two are not the same thing.
Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war. And we must reject the culture in which facts themselves are manipulated and even manufactured.
So facts themselves are manipulated and manufactured, which, again, is essentially that what facts, by what metric are these facts, Joe? You know, there are plenty of facts that you guys don't like, that you just say, you just dismiss as conspiracy theories, like the overwhelming evidence, yes, that the 2020 election had some serious voter fraud or irregularities. Or how about facts that you, things that you claim are facts but are not facts, like the entirety of that Russia collusion nonsense, which was thoroughly debunked time and time again, and yet you still ran with it. And to this day, millions of people still actually believe that. Those kinds of facts, Joe?
Many centuries ago, St. Augustine, a saint of my church, wrote that a people was a multitude defined by the common objects of their love. Defined by the common objects of their love. What are the common objects we as Americans love that define us as Americans? I think we know. Opportunity, security, liberty, dignity, respect, honor, and yes, the truth. Recent weeks and months have taught us a painful lesson. There is truth and there are lies. Lies told for power and for profit. And each of us has a duty and a responsibility as citizens, as Americans, and especially as leaders, leaders who have pledged to honor our Constitution and protect our nation, to defend the truth and defeat the lies.
What's scary about this is he's calling on all Americans to help come together and essentially censor other Americans, essentially be part of this national, almost like this national police force, this national thought police force, this national speech police force, to help root out the lies that are told for power and profit. So, which, again, like you mentioned, this is highly subjective. There is no objective metric that you can use and say, okay, well, this particular news article is, you know, not telling the truth, unless you're going to back it up, unless you're going to counter it with other news articles. The way that what they want to do, is, what he's implying, is that he wants Americans to censor one another, kind of the way that Twitter is censoring people by just knocking it down. Twitter and Facebook, after the election, they immediately went into hyperdrive, just knocking everything down that they disagreed with, claiming it was factually incorrect, even if it was clearly factually correct, even if it could be verified that it was correct. If they disagreed with it, they were knocking it down and claiming that it was false. There was one time I overheard this conversation in D.C. There were these two young women who apparently work on Capitol Hill, but they were talking about how they were working with the Congress people that they work with, and they were fielding calls from people who were complaining about the fact that Twitter was censoring Breitbart, censoring conservative outlets, and they were saying, well, I'm trying to explain to them that it's not really – that free speech isn't the same as spreading misinformation, but they just can't seem to quite understand it. It's like you're living in – how do you explain this to somebody that when you're living in completely different realities? They see this stuff as truth and it's really misinformation. So you got to think about it in this mentality. And this is something that Americans really need to pay attention to, because this would not go – this won't be going in a good direction, in a direction that will enhance freedom if this narrative continues. The idea that suppressing misinformation is okay. It's not that you know, suppressing misinformation is not suppressing free speech. Drawing a distinction between misinformation and free speech. If someone is putting out misinformation, you know, in the United States, they're supposed to have a First Amendment right to do that. And you should not have a corporate cartel that suppresses that any more than you should have the government suppressing that speech.
And as bad as it is that it's these corporations and big tech companies that are doing this, the fact he is calling on regular American citizens to join him in this effort, I've always said that is the absolute worst thing to have come out of this coronavirus. Yes, I'll say it. Even worse than the people who have died, whatever the real number is, whether the CDC numbers or whatever it says, the worst thing that has come out of this is not even the lockdowns or the state mandated, you know, state troopers showing up to arrest a business owner, whatever. The worst thing to come out of it is that Biden and the left and the Democrats, who have pushed this mentality that this is the second coming of the Black Plague and we need a lockdown, you need to wear masks, you need to social distance, you need to get a vaccine, you need to do whatever government tells you to. They have turned half the population into narcs. They have turned half the population into this citizen patrol unit that will, you see all these videos of people, citizens harassing other citizens for not wearing a mask. You see a video of some older woman screaming at like a 9-year-old girl in a grocery store for not wearing a mask. You see these videos of people, you know, harassing their fellow citizens because they're not following the government's rules. If it was just the government doing this and the entire population was united in the American spirit of independence and civil liberty to stand against this, that would be one thing. It would be certainly much more manageable. But when it's the government with half the population, at least half the population on its side, that's going to widen the divide even more and make things even worse than they already are, long after this virus is gone.
So imagine that every single citizen was empowered to record people speeding.
And if they, oh boy.
Imagine if every single citizen was issued a radar, and if they recorded someone speeding, they had the legal right to take a picture of their license plate and show, you know, I guess I don't know anything about speed radars, but if, let's say, if you can show the date and when it was recorded, they can take that to the police department and they could show that this person was speeding. Imagine if they got rewarded monetarily for that. So every single time that a citizen turns in another citizen for speeding, they get paid for it. Can you imagine the distrust that would be sown among American citizens? Can you imagine the hatred and the resentment and just how awful it would be to live in America? If you know that every single car on the road could potentially be monitoring your, not only monitoring your speed, but also taking a picture of your license plate, and they could look up your license plate online and find out where you live. So not only could you get a speeding ticket, not only would they get paid for turning you in, but you could potentially have people show up to your house and harass you for breaking the rules, breaking the law. And this is very Chinese when you think about it. You think
social
about
credit scores.
Social credit score. This is what Biden is proposing, is a soft, basically trying to get Americans accustomed to that kind of culture. So you can eventually move toward a culture where citizens police other citizens and keep them in check and make sure that they don't step out of the social norms and the social boundaries. And I saw this chick on Instagram. She is known as DC City Girl. She took a picture and put it on her story of these people standing at the Lincoln Memorial. And she took a picture of this one woman with her back to her. And the caption said she wasn't wearing a mask. Just this random woman who's just standing, looking out. She's by herself. There's no one within 50 feet of her. She's just looking out over the National Mall. This woman takes a picture of her back, just takes a picture of her back and puts the caption, "What? She wasn't wearing a mask." So now she's just taking a picture of her back. What if, you know, if this keeps going, she'll be taking a picture of people's faces. You know, she'll be, and eventually, you know, taking pictures again, you know, following people to the car, taking a picture of their license plate. There is no limit to this. This goes, and this is the way things work.
Unity, everybody.
Right, right. This is the way it was in East Germany during communist East Germany. The Stasi, the secret police, had like a million people that were snitches, that were in society, snitching on anyone who told a political joke, anything, you know, anything that was not condoned by the government. So this is definitely a dangerous path to go down, and Americans need to start paying attention. A lot of Trump supporters are just kind of tuning out. They're like, okay, whatever, this, you know, this election was stolen, it's over. It's not just politics. It's also society at large that we need to start paying attention to.
And you know who wasn't wearing a mask, who was actually photographed and videoed and broadcast not wearing a mask at the Lincoln Memorial? Joe Biden and his entire family.
Oh, I believe it. I mean, this is kind of most politicians. They do the same thing. Like the governor of California, Newsom, he was out partying with people without a mask before, right after the election. The mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms, she was yucking it up with Joe Biden, you know, a bunch of other people without masks. So this is just par for the course for politicians.
Look, I understand that many of my fellow Americans view the future with fear and trepidation. I understand they worry about their jobs. I understand, like my dad, they lay in bed staring at the ceiling, wondering, can I keep my health care? Can I pay my mortgage? Thinking about their families, about what comes next. I promise you, I get it. But the answer is not to turn inward, to retreat into competing factions, distrusting those who don't look like you, or worship the way you do, or don't get their news from the same sources you do. We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, or rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this if we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts, if we show a little tolerance and humility, and if we're willing to stand in the other person's shoes, as my mom would say, just for a moment, stand in their shoes.
How much of that was ripped from President Trump's inaugural address, by the way? That actually sounds very similar. You know, President Trump said, you know, whether you are white or black or brown, we all bleed the same red blood of patriots. Like, a lot of that, even then, again, ripped straight from his predecessor. He just cannot stop committing plagiarism. The man simply cannot keep getting away with it.
This segment of his speech was, I thought, was telling, because you hear a lot of times the left doesn't understand the right, but the right understands the left. The reason for this is it's not that the left never reads what the right writes. It's not that the left never listens to what the right says. It's that when people on the right say something, the left doesn't believe them. And when people on the left say something, the right does believe them. So, for instance, when people on the left say, we want to end fracking, or let's say we want to end the Keystone XL pipeline, people on the right believe them. They believe that's what they actually believe, that's what they want to do. When people on the right say, we want a nation for Americans, we believe in nationalism, people on the left don't believe that that's actually what we want. They say, well, you're just saying that because you're facing economic insecurity. You're wondering how you're going to pay your mortgage. You're wondering where if you're renting, if your next paycheck is going to be able to cover the rent. You're just facing economic insecurity. Maybe you live in the Rust Belt. And this is what Joe Biden is harping on here. He's saying this is really the only part of his speech where he actually tries to reach out to some part of Trump supporters, where he actually tries to reach out to the forgotten men and women in middle America who, you know, the former blue collar workers who lost their jobs are now flipping burgers for a living or having to drive trucks for a living and not see their families except maybe once every 2 weeks. He's trying to reach out to them. But if you listen to what he says, it shows that his mentality is that, or at least the mentality, again, I don't think, you know, it's questionable how much of this Joe Biden actually believes and how much of this is just given to him to say. But it's showing that the left's mentality is those of you in the Rust Belt that voted for Trump, we want to let you know we hear you, we understand your economic pain, but you don't need to turn that economic pain into xenophobia. And again, the reason why people support nationalism and they support an America First agenda, it doesn't have anything to do with xenophobia. It doesn't have anything to do with economic pain. Yes, Trump came along and he wanted to speak to the blue collar workers. He wanted to try to rebuild industrial America. He wanted to help out the coal miners. And people would vote for that no matter if it was Republican or Democrat. But when it comes to the nationalism that the Republican Party has turned to. It's not turned into nationalism because of economic insecurity. It's turned into nationalism because it's normal. Nationalism is inherent. It's something that we're born with. We're born with the desire to care for people in our own country. We hire a politician. It's like you hire a politician to work for you. You don't expect that politician to work for foreigners. You expect him to work for you. And so this is something that the left doesn't seem to understand. This happened in Europe, actually. In 2015, Europe was still struggling from the recession. And nationalist right-wing parties started making serious headway in Western European countries that people never thought they would have any success in.
Especially after Brexit.
Correct. And people were saying, well, this must be the reason why they're getting elected in Sweden, places like Denmark and, you know,
France
Holland.
Even.
Yeah, even France, even Germany. You have the alternative for Germany was actually getting, you know, like hitting 10%. People are like, how is this possible? And they're trying to explain it, saying, okay, well, it's because people are being hurt financially. Once the economy starts picking up, these right-wing parties will die out. But the opposite actually happened. As the economy improved in 2016, 2017, these right-wing parties actually increased their percentage of the vote. They actually started doing better. And people are trying to figure out, you know, these internationalists are trying to figure out, why is this happening? But again, it goes back to the fact that they see everything in economic terms. They don't see anything in tribalistic or nationalistic terms. They assume that if someone becomes tribalistic or if someone supports nationalism, it's because they're hurting economically. They can't imagine the fact, they can't wrap their head around the fact that people are nationalistic inherently.
And I know this was just a whole bunch of platitudes he was speaking there, but the absolute audacity of Joe Biden to lecture anyone about, oh, people wondering if they're going to have their health care. Yeah, after the entire Obamacare debacle, which you were a right-hand man to, you have no right to talk about that ever again, Joe. But speaking of foreign policy,
we all understand the world is watching all of us today. So here's my message to those beyond our borders. America has been tested, and we've come out stronger for it. We will repair our alliances and engage with the world once again, not to meet yesterday's challenges, but today's and tomorrow's challenges. And we'll lead not merely by the example of our power, but by the power of our example. We'll be a strong and trusted partner for peace, progress, and security. Look, you all know we've been through so much in this nation. In my first act as president, I'd like to ask you to join me.
And I just want to go ahead and translate for you what he says. You know, we'll fix our broken alliances and, you know, America is back, baby. Translation. We're going to go back to paying for all of your militaries. We're going to go back to paying for all your alliances. You won't have to pay anything anymore. NATO, the UN, we'll go back to funding you guys. We'll go back to bending over backwards to accommodate you guys in every way possible, just like the Obama administration did. I'm always so sick of this talking point people say is, oh, world leaders and other countries' populations approve more of the United States under Obama than under Donald Trump. Yet, of course they did, because Obama gave them everything they wanted. They approve of him because he didn't put American interests first. And of course they don't like Donald Trump because he put Americans first. They, of course, are not going to like that. But Biden has to come along and say, this again is an appeal to authority. Oh, multiple world leaders say we're better off under an Obama or a Biden than a Trump, as if that's supposed to mean anything.
Yeah, those world leaders didn't vote for the American president. The American citizens voted for the president. And okay, so the argument here that he's making is America is back. Like he said, America is back, baby, talking to the international leaders of the world. And this plays to the notion that the American president is the leader of the free world. America's president is no longer the leader of the free world because the dichotomy between the free world and the communist world doesn't exist anymore. The last president of the United States of America who was the leader of the free world was George Bush Sr. When the Soviet Union fell, you no longer had the Cold War. You no longer had the free world versus the communist enslaved world. The American president is just the president of the United States of America. There is no free world for him to lead. He's supposed to lead America. So, you know, this concept, this is really what Joe Biden is playing into. He's just basically saying, I'm going to continue the neo-Cold War policies of the Bushes and Obama. And, you know, that's kind of what we can look forward to for the next 4 years. This is elections have consequences, and this is unfortunately the direction we're going. I will say, though, that I was encouraged by the fact that he claimed that he used the wording, America should lead by the
example of our power and the power of our example.
Yeah, by the power of our example more so than the example of our power. So most presidents at the start, they will make a similar statement. George W. Bush made a similar statement. So it's kind of like, you know, if he can if he can govern like Obama did without the foreign interventions, you know, okay, yeah, we're going to join the Paris Climate Accord. We're going to continue to pay for Europe's defense. If he could just keep us out of war for 4 years, America could survive this.
Folks, this is a time of testing. We face an attack on our democracy and on truth, a raging virus, growing inequity, the sting of systemic racism, a climate in crisis, America's role in the world. Any one of these would be enough to challenge us in profound ways. But the fact is, we face them all at once, presenting this nation with one of the gravest responsibilities we've had. Now we're going to be tested. Are we going to step up, all of us? It's time for boldness, for there's so much to do. And this is certain. I promise you, we will be judged, you and I, by how we resolve these cascading crises of our era. We will rise to the occasion is the question. Will we master this rare and difficult hour? Will we meet our obligations and pass along a new and better world to our children? I believe we must. I'm sure you do as well. I believe we will. And when we do, we'll write the next great chapter in the history of the United States of America, the American story.
So this is another example of why we can't come together. We can't have unity. So I've talked to a lot of centrists. You know, there's a lot of very level-headed centrists around the Washington, D.C. area. Of course, it's a very educated area. So you'll meet a lot of independents, a lot of Democrats who, like, voted for Bush, Obama, Romney, Trump, Biden, that type of voter. And a lot of these people, they'll argue that, you know, let's stop arguing about all the social stuff like transgender bathrooms. Let's just focus on solutions to help the American people. They're basically like the consensus type voters. Let's just work together for the American people. But the problem with that is you can't work with someone on a solution to a problem if you don't both agree that there's a problem. So if somebody comes to my house and they say, okay, I'm a plumber, I'm here to fix your toilet, I can say, well, my toilet's just fine. It flushes fine. I don't need a plumber. No. We're here. I'm here to help you fix your toilet. And they just insist. I'm like, no. Look, I can't. I'm going to have to ask you to leave. I don't need your help. No. Look, I'm going to help you. Let's just work together to find a solution to fix your toilet. And they bring back up and they're like, if you don't stand aside, we're going to have to go in and fix your toilet. How do you come to common ground with like, my toilet is fine. I don't need you coming into my house to try to fix my toilet. It's perfectly fine. But they're wanting to work together on a solution when there isn't a problem. And all of these crises that Joe Biden lists, no Republican anywhere believes that any of this stuff is a crisis.
So half of this stuff is manufactured by the left, right, to become crises, quote unquote.
There is no climate crisis. There is no systemic racism in America. None of this stuff, none of the things that he lists are crises or problems. We can agree that the coronavirus is a problem, but he doesn't even list the coronavirus in this list. We can agree that, okay, yeah, healthcare is a problem. We do have a healthcare problem in this country. There are countries who have better healthcare than the United States. We can sit down as Democrats and Republicans and find solutions to the coronavirus, to healthcare, different things like this. But with the so-called climate crisis, with systemic racism, again, these are bones that he's throwing to the two wings of his party. You've got black middle class and even some rich black people who are essentially black nationalists, black identitarians. And then you have rich upper middle class white people who are climate freaks. And Joe Biden he's got to try to keep them happy. And he's telling Republicans, telling the nation, let's come together and find solutions to these problems. Republicans don't believe that there is a climate crisis. Republicans don't believe that systemic racism exists. You can't have us join you at the table to find solutions to non-existent problems. You've got to first convince us that these problems exist. And so far, you've done a really, really piss poor job of convincing anybody that these problems exist. In fact, you've turned more people away from the idea of the conclusion that there is actually a climate crisis or that there's actually systemic racism by the way you've treated your adversary. So again, this is just like the faux unity that he's trying to push. No, we can't have unity on this. You know, you have power. Sure, I guess you, by the force of your power, by Kamala Harris being the deciding vote in the Senate, you can try to ram something down America's throat on the so-called systemic racism or so-called climate crisis, but don't expect any help from us. Expect nothing but opposition from us every step of the way.
And like I said, we've been playing this video, his speech, at 1.25 speed on YouTube because A, to get through it as quickly as possible, but B, because he talks so slow. So we're going to wrap it up here at double speed. And I guarantee you, you're only going to notice a very slight difference because this is how a normal person who is not 78 years old and obviously falling into dementia would be talking.
Sorry, that might sound something like a song that means a lot to me. It's called American Anthem. There's one verse.
that stands out, at least for me, and it goes like this. The work and prayers of centuries have brought us to this day. What shall be our legacy? What will our children say? Let me know in my heart when my days are through. America, America, I gave my best to you. Let us add our own work and prayers to the unfolding story of our great nation. If we do this, then when our days are through, our children and our children's children will save us. They gave their best. They did their duty. They healed a broken land. My fellow Americans, I close the day where I began with a sacred oath. Before God and all of you, I give you my word. I will always level with you. I will defend the Constitution. I'll defend our democracy. I'll defend America. And I'll give all of you, keep everything I do in your service, thinking not of power, but of possibilities, not of personal interest, but the public good. And together, we shall write an American story of hope, not fear, of unity, not division, of light, not darkness, a story of decency and dignity, love and healing, greatness and goodness. May this be the story that guides us, the story that inspires us, and the story that tells ages yet to come that we answered the call of history. We met the moment. Democracy and hope, truth and justice did not die in our watch, but thrived. That America secured liberty at home and stood once again as a beacon to the world. That is what we owe our forebears, one another, and generation to follow. So, with purpose and resolve, we turn to those tasks of our time, sustained by faith, driven by conviction, and devoted to one another and the country we love with all our hearts. May God bless America, and may God protect our troops. Thank you, America.
So with purpose and resolve, we have a duty to our nation to oppose the Biden agenda, to oppose the internationalist agenda that they would seek to ram down our throats and turn this country into something that was never founded to be. With purpose and resolve, we need to go forth and conquer this menace to American democracy that they would try to impose on us. So, yeah, you know, I can agree with that at the end if you kind of interpret it that way. So after Biden walks off, then Amanda Gorman, who is National Poet Laureate, first one that they named such, she comes up and she gives a pretty decent poem.
Mr. President, Dr. Biden, Madam Vice President, Mr. Emhoff, Americans and the world. When day comes, we ask ourselves, where can we find light in this never-ending shade? The loss we carry, a sea we must wade. We've braved the belly of the beast. We've learned that quiet isn't always peace. In the norms and notions of what just is, isn't always just is. And yet the dawn is ours before we knew it. Somehow we do it. Somehow we've weathered and witnessed a nation that isn't broken, but simply unfinished. We, the successors of a country and a time where a skinny black girl descended from slaves and raised by a single mother, can dream of becoming president.
I just got to stop at this point. So for those of you who don't know, again, she's a poet laureate. This is supposed to be a poem, by the way. She's recited. This is all a poem. This is what's known. I was introduced to this concept in college. This is what's called slam poetry. This is basically poetry for, you know, oppressed minorities, historically oppressed groups, to basically rant and whine about how oppressed they are.
That's an actual genre of poetry?
Yes, slam poetry. That is actually a thing. And you're seeing this young black girl literally already preaching about the systemic racism and inequality in America. This is literally the kind of stuff you would see on a college campus. The inauguration of the next president of the United States has become a literal college campus, folks. That's where we are at this point.
I didn't realize that was an actual genre of poetry, because it sounded like she had watched Hamilton and she was trying to mimic the way that they did the poetry in the rapping poetry in Hamilton. I didn't realize this is an actual genre. But one thing that stands out about the part we just played is she mentions this is a nation that isn't finished. And this really plays to the ideology that they believe. And when I say they, I'm talking about the black nationalist wing of the Democratic Party, and now the Democratic Party as a whole. They don't see the United States as a nation. They see it as a work in progress. See, from our perspective and our ideology, or our philosophy, if you will, we believe that the nation became a nation in 1776. Now, you can improve a nation, but that doesn't mean that you're continually creating the nation. So you create is like a person is born. And that person grows. The person isn't growing into a human being. They've been a human being since birth, if you believe it, at conception and since conception. But they've been a human being all along. They're not continually evolving into a human being. And this is the way they view nationhood. They view the United States as this entity that's becoming a nation rather than a nation that is slowly or even quickly improving itself. And this is, again, you can't have unity with this. This isn't an ideological difference. This is a total philosophical difference that cannot be bridged.
Only to find herself reciting for one. And yes, we are far from polished, far from pristine, but that doesn't mean we are striving to form a union that is perfect. We are striving to forge our union with purpose, to compose a country committed to all cultures, colors, characters, and conditions of man. And so we lift our gaze not to what stands between us, but what stands before us. We close the divide because we know to put our future first. We must first put our differences aside. We lay down our arms so we can...
Our future first. You know, she said put our future first. Whose future exactly is she referring to, by the way?
That's a good question. That's a really good question.
We reach out our arms to one another. We seek harm to none and harmony for all. Let the globe, if nothing else, say this is true. That even as we grieved, we grew. That even as we hurt, we hoped. That even as we tired, we tried. That we'll forever be tied together, victorious. Not because we will never again know defeat, but because we will never again sow division. Scripture tells us to envision that everyone shall sit under their own vine and fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. If we're to live up to our own time, then victory won't lie in the blade, but in all the bridges we've made. That is the promised glade, the hill we climb, if only we dare it. Because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it.
So she's talking about repairing the past. I mean, first off, I'm pretty sure that's by the logic of, unless time travel exists, it's impossible to repair the past.
You can't repair the past, but it just shows how she sees, and again, this isn't just her. There's a whole ideology behind this that's behind the Democratic Party. They see the American past as broken. We see the American past as glorious. They see the American past as evil. We see the American past as something to emulate. And this is something that cannot be bridged. You can't have unity in a country when half the country looks at the past as evil and half the country looks at the past as glorious. This is a bridge that cannot be fixed.
These are two different worldviews that cannot coexist with one another.
Correct.
We've seen a force that would shatter our nation rather than share it, would destroy our country if it meant delaying democracy.
Okay, so this
delaying democracy.
So again, something else they believe. They don't believe we're a country. They believe we're becoming a country. They don't believe we're a democracy. They believe we're becoming a democracy. But whenever you run through the Capitol building like a bunch of wild savages, they say that you're defiling democracy. But wait a minute, I thought we're becoming democracy. So according to Gorman, we're not yet a democracy. Where she's claiming that people are trying to delay democracy in the suggestion that we haven't yet achieved democracy.
And this effort very nearly succeeded. But while democracy can be periodically delayed, it can never be permanently defeated. In this truth, in this faith we trust, for while we have our eyes on the future, history has its eyes on us. This is the era of just redemption. We feared it at its inception. We did not feel prepared to be the heirs of such a terrifying hour, but within it we found the power to author a new chapter, to offer hope and laughter to ourselves. So, while once we asked,
Rhyme, like really forced rhymes that aren't even really rhymes. Again, because once again, this is supposed to be poetry, people. This is like modern art. This is the kind of quote unquote poetry you get from colleges these days, you know, when black studies majors are running around and are considered, you know, it's considered a legitimate school of thought in American academia today.
How could we possibly prevail over catastrophe? Now we assert. How could catastrophe possibly prevail over us? We will not march back to what was, but move to what shall be, a country that is bruised but whole, benevolent but bold, fierce and free. We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation because we know our inaction and inertia will be the inheritance of the next generation. Our blunders become their burdens. But one thing is certain. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy.
Did a three-year-old write some of these rhymes? I'm sorry. This is just, again, this girl received a Nobel Prize for poetry? Are you kidding me? As an English minor, I'm minoring in English, folks, to sound a little bit bougie here. Yes, my minor is in English. I read a lot of great English literature, Shakespeare, some of the great American authors like Herman Melville. And to see how far literature has fallen in the English language is just very, very depressing. It makes me very sad.
And change our children's birthright. So let us leave behind a country better than the one we were left. With every breath from my bronze pounded chest, we will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. We will rise from the gold-limbed hills of the west. We will rise from the wind-swept northeast where our forefathers first realized revolution. We will rise from the lake-rimmed cities of the midwestern states. We will rise from the sun-baked south. We will rebuild, reconcile, and recover in every known nook of our nation, in every corner called our country. Our people, diverse and beautiful, will emerge battered and beautiful. When day comes, we step out of the shade, aflame and unafraid. The new dawn blooms as we free it. For there is always light if only we're brave enough to see it, if only we're brave enough to be it.
We will raise this wounded world into a wondrous one. Look, I mean, I don't really want – this is, again, you can't have union when half the country wants the country to create a wondrous world and half the country wants to create a wondrous America. I want to raise this America into a wondrous country. I don't really care much about raising the wounded world into a wondrous world. And the imagery she uses at the end – This could very easily have been written by a young Bolshevik poet in Russia 100 years ago. This is another reason why there can be no reconciliation between the right and the left in this country. There is no golden dawn that we can create on this sin-filled earth full of sinful people, and anyone who tries will always turn into a tyrant. Anyone who tries to create a new world and bring in, it'll heal the world, will always turn into a tyrant. So this is the furthest thing we want to have, you know, anything to do with, especially we don't want anything like this anywhere near the halls of our government.
I want to take this moment to essentially kind of metaphorically throw holy water on a demon here. I'm going to counter this horrendous abortion of the American language with some actual literature. Thank you very much. The antidote to this, go read Ralph Waldo Emerson's The American Scholar. That is a truly great speech about what it means to be an American thinker and an American intellectual, given, of course, by one of the great American intellectuals, Ralph Waldo Emerson. And I will also, I just got to say, I will counter this. This is my holy water here. You ready? I'm going to counter this with something that is very simple, but is a piece of some of the greatest literature ever written in the English language. You may recognize this excerpt. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. This is the way the world ends. Not with a bang, but a whimper. All right, I'm done. My bougie side is done. I can go back to being that guy with a podcast now. I've shedded my degree. I'm back to being that guy with a podcast.
Yeah, well, I did a little bit of background research on Amanda Gorman. She seems to be a bit of a black ethno-nationalist, which I would call ethno-narcissist. You can't really blame her. I mean, she is extremely talented. I won't take that away from her. But so her mother, this is from the Harvard Crimson. It says the Gormans trace their creativity and activism to their mother, talking about Amanda and her sister. They trace their creativity to their mother, who only let them watch 1940s sitcoms like The Munsters and The Honeymooners, one of which includes a character that Gorman cites as the first feminist TV icon. So in order for them to watch anything other than the 1940s sitcoms, they had to tie that to social activism. So in other words, if they wanted to watch a modern movie, they had to explain to their mother how that movie ties into social activism, and then their mother would let them watch the movie. So imagine you're growing up, you're a kid, and you're only allowed to watch 1940s sitcoms, black and white sitcoms. And if you want any other entertainment, you've got to study social activism, social justice movements, and tie that whatever you want to watch to those movements. I mean, yeah, I can see myself becoming ethno-narcissist activist if that's the kind of childhood I had. This is almost like whenever someone's want their child to become a master violinist and they beat their fingers with a ruler if they make a mistake. That's basically the way this poor girl was raised by her mother.
Yeah, I just, like I said, there is a reason that I did not watch the entirety of the Biden inauguration with the volume on, but it still just made me very, very sad to realize that there really are that many people, a sizable amount of people who believe this crap, who actually have this outlook on America right now. And the fact, the worst fact of them all being that now people like that have Joe Biden's ear as president of the United States for as long as he is president, until sooner or later something happens, which you know it will, and we're going to get Kamala Harris as president, and that's going to be 10 times worse. But we're going to be here for all of that. Regardless, we're going to get through. We're going to get through the storm and the wrong. We're going to get through the thick and the thin. We will rise up. Allow me to get a little slam poetry here. We will be the phoenix that will rise up from the ashes of the oppression and rise out of this endless shadow, this endless night, this endless darkness. Am I doing it right, Jacob? Is this slam poetry?
Yeah,
done right?
You're getting close. You're not quite as good. You're not quite as good as a person of color, but you're getting close.
I need to brush up on my poetry. Then I'd really be able to take him to the cleaners. All right. Until next time, thank you guys so much for listening to this special edition of The Right Take. We will catch you next time, guys.